We're about to discuss a book called On a Barbarous Coast, timely in Reconciliation Week, where we're trying to revisit all sorts of aspects of white and black relationships in this country. So let's look at what happened in July 1770, when Cook's Endeavour was caught on the Great Barrier Reef and had to come on shore to make repairs. Now, the captain and the crew spent about 48 days in what's now Cooktown, Queensland, and during this time, they got to dispel some of their intense fears of the local people. Now, On a Barbarous Coast is a very interesting book. It's a novel jointly written by Craig Cormick, an award-winning author from Canberra. Craig's written any number of books. And Harold Ludwick, who's a Bulkun Warra man from Cooktown, who now works for the National Trust of Australia. Craig began writing the book alone about the mariners who spent 48 days on the land, now Cooktown, while the Endeavour was being repaired, but realised he couldn't write the story from both perspectives without an Indigenous expert. Enter Harold. Now, Harold grew up in a bush shack, split palm walls and a tarp for the roof before his dad built a proper house. He learnt as a young bloke how to hunt and shoot and survive off the land. He's worked many jobs, including station hand, miner, block lawyer, Indigenous ranger, but has always had a passion for telling the great stories of his people. So, first of all, to you, Harold, how did you feel when you got approached by this odd white fella?
Yeah, it was out of the blue, but it fit so well with what I was telling in the James Cook Museum of the Indigenous heritage and the relationships they had with Cook as well. And so I was well versed in the story of Cook for the 48 days, and I could tell the story from our perspective, from a shore to ship rather than the ship to shore.
Craig, how did you track down Harold? How did you find him?
That's a bit of a story in itself, Philip. I went up to Cooktown a couple of times. I've been up there, and I went out to meet a lot of the Indigenous community and asked for recommendations. Every time I met someone, I asked for another recommendation. And I tell them the vision of what I was working on. If they looked at me like, what? And I thought, okay, this isn't going to work. But a couple of them looked at me and thought, oh, I get that. That's going to be so good. And Harold was one of them. And when I sat down with him, he was working at the Art Centre then. I talked about, you know, so here's this idea of this book and Cook, and what if they come across shipwrecks? And he went straight into it as if, yeah, this could have happened. And under these circumstances, they would have got spear. And under these circumstances, they wouldn't. And I thought, we're away.
Now, it has to be said that creative collaborations are always fraught with problems. Look at Gilbert and Sullivan, for heaven's sake. Has it been a happy partnership? I'll put that to you, Harold.
Oh, yeah, it's been great because
You've knocked him into shape.
Yeah, well, you know, living on different parts of the... He lives on the arse end of Australia and lives up the top end.
Craig, would you echo that happy interpretation?
Harold's been down to Canberra in winter, actually, so he knows it in the best times. He's been down here and I've been up there, so we've had a good chance to, you know, check out each another's the country we're each other living in, and we can have the pluses and minuses of it. But me and Harold really hit it off. We just got off tremendously well.
We all know the story of The Fatal Shore, about the title of that famous book. Tell me about the title of A Barbarous Coast, Craig.
Sure. It comes from a quote by Sidney Parkinson, who was the artist or illustrator on the voyage. And he was a timorous type of chap, I think we might call him. And he wrote in his journal after the Endeavour had hit the reef, in retrospect, he wrote, "About 11, the ship struck upon the rocks and remained immovable. We were at this period many thousand leagues from our native land, which we had left upward of 2 years, and on a barbarous coast, where if the ship had been wrecked and we had escaped the perils of the sea, we would have fallen into the rapacious hands of savages." So it's trying to capture that feeling, that fear. they had of this unknown land and the unknown people.
Well, it expresses the fear very clearly indeed. Tell me about Sidney Robinson, the Scottish artist who held these fears.
Sidney Parkinson. He was a Quaker. He was a very interesting guy. Unfortunately, he died in Batavia, like a lot of the crew did when they got there succumbed. But the really interesting thing about him is he voiced the fear they all had of being sent, lost ashore where the natives were. But over the time, over those 48 days, like many of the crew, like Cook as well, they came to think of the people quite differently.
Well, now, let's not rush ahead. Now, you describe him, the two of you, in the book as a pious little Bible basher.
Yes.
True?
Indeed. So, yes, it's close to him. We tried to capture the truth of many of the people as we could. While it's a work of fiction, we try to keep everything we could as close to fact as possible, including the characters.
Is it true that that this guy recorded the first written account of Indigenous language, including kangaroo, with Joe
Banks?
I'll
let Harold answer that one.
Harold?
Yes, definitely. Kangaroo, and it was one of the 132 words they collected while they were here.
Oh, look, say it again, mate. Say it again. It sounds terrific.
Gangoro.
That's much better. Qantas has a flying gangaroo. I love it.
And I've actually done the footage piece for that as well.
Dear, oh, dear. Now, is it right that if Cook had landed 1 kilometre north of the Endeavour River, that he and the others might well have been speared? Once again, I put that to you, Harold.
Yes, definitely, because where they landed was a neutral area. It was like the UN, and this is where all the tribes or clans could come in and negotiate peace instead of going to full-scale war. So it was a neutral place where no blood was to be intentionally spilt, and that translates over into Philip Parker King's visit to the same area in 1819 and 1820.
How extraordinary and fortuitous that this occurred.
Yeah, mate, you couldn't have scripted it better than that. And the relationships they built is something that we should look upon in these trying times,
Tell me about the local Indigenous people, the Bama. At first, of course, and this is not unusual, around the world in the initial first contacts, they thought the whites were spirit people.
That's right. And one of our stories is we believe that a couple of our ancestors, Milkandur and Kalkawunkul, went from the west to the east, and they were waiting for them to return from the east. And along comes a ship with all these white people on, and that people took a month for them to get enough courage to get up close to them. But they thought for a while, are these people our ancestors, or are they evil spirits? So, it was a time where, they couldn't fathom what this were, because it's like you and I seeing a spaceship landing in front of us.
I haven't had that experience yet, but I'm not looking forward to it, to be honest. Now, Craig, back to you. Here's a collaboration between two odd blokes, different parts of the country, slightly different cultural backgrounds, and the book is told, or the novel is narrated similarly by two very different people. Tell me about the young Indigenous bloke who tells the Indigenous side of the story. Certainly he's full of that trepidation about the white visitor.
I'll get Harold to give you how we went that way, but we decided it had to be a boy, had to be a young person, because Cook had with him a Tahitian navigator, Tupaia, and he had a young boy. So we were looking for that bridge. What would get the white understanding, their view of the world, thinking these people are barbarous savages. We've just looked at what Harold explained, the Indigenous view of the whites as potentially spirits. How are we going to bridge that? And so we had to come up with a character from both sides that was potential to do that. And we found as children that was possible. And that's where we've got the story. And Harold can tell you why he's chosen Gargil to take that place.
Please do so.
Well, Garkil in our language means hawk. And, you know, they're inquisitive and they like to see things and look at things like that. So, and being children themselves, they're inquisitive. So it was a chance meeting between Garkil and the little servant boy of Tupaya that actually started that the relationship between the indigenous people and Cook survivors.
And the white narrator, tell me about him.
So that's James Mario Magra, a.k.a. Matra, who Matraville and Sydney is named after. He was American, actually, so he's a bit of an oddbod on the ship. There were a couple, he wasn't the only American, but he certainly didn't fit the British, role that all the other sailors generally came from. And he was interesting because he was critical of Cook. He was not, like most of the crew, were very much adulation of Cook as their captain. Mario was quite critical, and vice versa. Cook wrote some very cutting remarks about him in his journal. And so we wanted to get a point of view that didn't conform to the norm, someone who didn't belong.
Okay, we've now set it up, and we'll return to Magra shortly. But I want now to visit that scene when, on his arrival, Cook offers some fish to the locals, which they reciprocate the next day. But things get out of hand, and Cook shot at one of the indigenous men, and this was over his capture of a dozen turtles.
That's a story for Harold to pick up.
Yep, that's correct there. Well, when they went on board the Endeavour, Cook certainly writes in the journals that, you know, they took more notice of the turtles than anything else on board. And so what Cook didn't know was that we had a resource management in place. And it covers everything, the turtles as well as food and aquatic and terrestrial as well. And our people didn't know that he was replenishing his supplies to further his travels back to England.
So, and, you know, that was, I understand from the book they feared Cook was in possession of the queen of the turtles, the mother who was in charge of the lot, central to further reproduction.
That's the one, because we know that the female is responsible for continued resources in the area by laying eggs, because we call that mamingo in our language. And when you shorten that word to mami, mami means boss. So she is the boss. She keeps the resources happening.
You describe how the animals are sacred and protocols must be observed when hunting, and during the process of butchering, when the hunt is successful, men will chant all night until the first light of day.
That's right, that's right. And it's been recorded by Roth and that as well. It's a respect for that animal. I've seen the elder hit one of the younger people with a spear or a womra, a milper in their language. He flogged that young fella because the young fella was making fun of this dead dugong. And the elder felt offended for him doing that, and he hit the young man with a spear thrower.
Now, there's a season for hunting. This will be of great interest to the listeners. Animals cannot be hunted when they're giving birth or tending the young so that their offsprings can survive. Now, tell me about the elder who brought about the first reconciliation with James Cook over this conflict, this misunderstanding. Is it Yabarigu?
Yabarigu.
Tell me about him.
Yeah, he was the elder, so It was his right as the elder of that area to keep the sacredness of that area and keep the status quo. So when Captain Cook intentionally spilled blood by shooting one of our people through the arm or the leg, it was his duty to assert his cultural governance of the area by coming to Captain Cook and showing him a broken tipped spear. And that was a symbol of a peace. So by doing that, he got Captain Cook to understand, and Captain Cook had the presence of mind to understand this meant noble fighting. And so that started that reconciliation in 1770.
And I understand that some hills were set alight to smoke the area, to cleanse the land after fighting had occurred. Is it true that Banks recorded this in his journal?
That's right. Banks writes in his journal how magnificent the hills all look at night, set alight, and, you know, things like that. But unbeknownst to him, this was the cleansing of that area that was, they broke all law on. And so to bring it back to status quo, they had to cleanse it there. And, that still happens today.
Craig, you include the story of a French boy, Narciso Pelletier, who was 13, when he came to live with an indigenous tribe. He was, totally initiated, but later kidnapped and sent back to France.
That's right. We looked at trying to base our – and the stories you've just been talking with Harold are from real life, the reconciliation, not the story we've taken it in the novel. But we did base as much as we could on shipwreck survivors who've had to live with Aboriginal peoples, particularly on the east coast of Australia. And they included Narcisse Pelletier, Barbara Thompson, James Morrill, James Davis. And they all had Indigenous names. They lived with the people for many years. And people like Narcisse Pelletier lived so long that when Europeans again found him living with the tribe, they had to forcibly take him away. And he really spent a lot of his life wishing he could have gone back.
Harold, I love the story of the relationship between Magra, the recalcitrant American, and his nemesis, a crocodile. In the book, they talk a lot to each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's almost like a conscious of him, but the Gandhar, what we call Gandhar, the crocodile up here, you know, because it's a mystical animal itself, you know, dating back from the prehistoric times. And it's a sign of strength as well. And so it's something that fits in well with the story and Magra's thinking as well. And it's really powerful. And if you take away the characters, the underlying story is the story of respect of both cultures.
This conflict, and this is back to you, Craig, between Magra and Cook is really interesting.
Yes, we wanted to play out. I guess one of the things is in modern Australia, Cook is either demonised or lionised. And we wanted to try and find a bit of that with a bit more nuance, because ultimately the book is white fella story, black fella story, and as it goes on, the stories converge. And so we have the two cultures starting to understand, keep in contact with each other, and then the what if is not what if they were shipwrecked on the shore, but what if they had that reconciliation, understanding of each other's cultures so early that comes second settlement, second, you know, arrival, how might that have played out so differently?
Now, James Magra, midshipman,
yes,
you believe was the author of a journal of a voyage around the world in His Majesty's ship Endeavour. Why
indeed.
You believe this?
Well, I'm not the only one. So this book, Journal of a Voyage Around the World, His Majesty's Ship Endeavour, was published in 1771. He jumped the gun on Cook's journals. He jumped the gun on all the journals, and it was published anonymously to make a bit of a buck. And several scholars have looked at it and said, that's going to be Magra, because the reasons are it's clearly written from an outsider's point of view. In several points in the journal, he's critical of Cook. He actually gives some details that are not widely quoted in other journals and sources. So it's a really interesting read. And if you've got a spare $43,000 lying around, I see online that there's a first edition they've got for sale in the UK. You can get it online as well to have a look at it. Harold's had a read of it. And Magra, his point of view is a little bit different to the others. It's different from Banks, Parkinson, Cook, who you might call the canon, the traditional ones, not the canon thrown overboard, the traditional journals of the Endeavour. Magra has a different perspective.
Magra has the different perspective on Cook. He criticises some of Cook's decisions as putting the ship in danger. You instance sailing too close to the shore. And he was physically disciplined by Cook. Did that really happen?
That's right, he was, and he was demoted from midshipman down to the ranks just a week or so before they hit the rocks off the Great Barrier Reef, hit the reef. So there was an incident on board where Cook's clerk, his personal clerk, James Orton, had gotten drunk. You know, he was a bit of a drunkard, and Matra and him had bad blood, and someone had come in the night, cut his clothes, and then chopped bits of his earlobes off while he was in a drunken stupor. And Matra got the blame for it because he'd had a previous history. I don't think it was Matra. I think it was another member of the crew who did it. But Matra vehemently denied his innocence the whole time. But Cook gave him a dressing down, described him in his journal as one of those gentlemen of which the Navy has little use for, and stripped him of his rank.
I should explain to the listener that everything that happens in the book has happened at some time in our history, but not necessarily in Cooktown.
That's right.
Well, child rape, murder, the subsequent death of the murderer who'd violated local law, the disappearance of a midshipman who just walked off into the dunes without a word, on and on. So you've brought all these other threads together and rewoven them.
Yes. So we wanted to the first thing is the Cooktown story, the actual story, almost no one in Australia knows it. Everyone knows Botany Bay, there for a week, and Botany Bay gets all the good press and publicity. Cooktown was really much more significant, what happened on the Endeavour River. Very few people know it. We wanted to capture that story, but capture the truth of it by capturing as many historical truths we could and bring them together.
What's your view, Harold, of Cook, in summary?
Well, I think because he came from a humble beginning, his father couldn't even afford his education. His father's employer actually paid for that. He understood to live a simple life, what it meant, because it stands out in what Cook wrote about the Indigenous people of the Endeavour River. He said, they are far more happier than us. They have no want for material things. And, it goes on to show that, he understood that we didn't need much, but we were far more happier in our surroundings and comfortable with the way we live, because that shows out too when banks and them try to give our people beads and nails and necklaces, and they threw it away. It was only when they gave them the fish our people were overjoyed, because there was a practical use. It was food.
Spoiler alert, dear listener, it's a very different ending for Captain Cookie. I don't want to tell you the plot, but he doesn't get to leave Queensland. But I now have to leave my guests, Harold and Craig, on a barbarous coast. A collaboration by Harold Ludwig and Craig Cormick is published now by Allen and Unwin.